Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so excited to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. My guest will be Annie Novak, who is the co-founder of the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm and also a program called Growing Chefs, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to tell you more about her in a little bit when she comes on. But first, I just want to go over some things going on in and around the news and some events in the city that you might be interested in and share my recipe with you. So let's start with some of the things going on in the city. First let's start with what I blogged about this week. You know, what I blogged about is just how freaked out I am about what's going on in the world all around us. You know, every day I wake up to NPR, listening to the morning edition, and, you know, I have that station on throughout most of the day, or it's certainly in my car. Anytime I get into my car, there's NPR. And I am just so upset about, first off, Leonard Lopate and Jonathan Schwartz from NPR, who are hosts and have been on the radio show, Leonard Lopate, I think 50 years. They're just old standards, and they have now been accused of something. They don't even know what yet. And, you know, Al Franken stepping down, and just the political climate we are in right now is just horrendous. I mean, I certainly don't support sexual harassment, obviously, or intimidation or any power control that goes on with that. But I also, you know, have to appreciate that times change, just like, you know, the situation with the monuments that we have. You know, I mean, yes, Columbus Monument is up there, and, you know, do we really want to honor someone like Columbus? You know, maybe not, but there's some history that goes along with it. And, you know, the times in the, you know, 1960s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, where not sexual harassment, but was more acceptable behavior. I don't know. It's just very hard. I mean, of course, sexual harassment's not okay, and I'm really thrilled that we are addressing that. But some inappropriateness that took place that was acceptable in our society years ago, I don't know that we can go back and undo that. You know, what's going on now, we need to address for sure. And what's going on now in our government is just horrendous. I mean, you know, this president that is sitting in the White House is just scary, and everyone attached to him and everyone he's assigning is scary. And it's just horrible every day. And, you know, we have to stay strong. And, you know, I've talked to many people about how do you stay strong. And I think the way that you stay strong and stay above it all is to stay active in it, not to ignore it, but to actually become politically engaged. And I know that's something that many of us have not done before, and it's not something that we like doing. But in order for us to resist what is going on, we need to let our voices be heard. And the only way they are going to be heard, yes, we can sign petitions and we can make calls to our elected officials, but we also need to get out there and show up and be accounted for. And there are so many different events and rallies going on. It's impossible to go to all of them, but we all can go to some of them. And I think we really need to start looking at where we can put our support and energies. Rise and Resist is an incredible organization that I only recently learned about that, you know, organizes people coming together all the time. My daughter's been on a bus the last few weeks down to Washington. I just heard this week she actually got arrested in front of a senator's office, you know, lying down and just resisting. And, of course, it didn't even make the papers. None of it, you know, I think 300 people were arrested, didn't make the papers. Years ago, when I was arrested for the Keystone Pipeline, it didn't make the papers. You know, they're not reporting on the activism, but as it gets bigger, they're going to have to. And we all need to really start showing up, because we can't let our government be taken away from us and turned into a fascist, horrible, horrible government. We really need to hold on to the ideals that our country was founded on freedom, although, again, we can't go back there because it was founded, you know, exploiting the Native Americans, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, history is not a beautiful thing. But our country has been a pretty remarkable country, and I don't like the direction it's taking. And we need to all really rally behind that and do something about it. So anyway, some things going on in the city that are wonderful. Tonight, there's Cocktails with a Conscience, Addressing Hunger in New York City. And that's taking place at Repair the World New York City in Brooklyn. And Repair the World and Hunger Free New York are coming together for this event tonight. And they are going to be promoting their causes, addressing hunger issues in the areas, and it is a fundraiser. So come on down to that. December 14th, Food and Water Watch, which is another wonderful organization that is really protecting our food supplies and water and raising awareness about this. They're having their annual holiday party. It's a potluck at the Shelter Rock Unitarian Church on Shelter Rock Road in Manhasset. That's the Long Island one. I know they also have one in the city for their city chapter. So go to the Food and Water Watch website and also just find out what they're doing. This is also a time of giving to these organizations that we all want to support. There are so many, and I know we can't give to all of them, but definitely it's time of giving back, and you can do it through actions, and you can also do it through monetary donations. So find those organizations doing the work that you like and help them out. December 15th, NOFA New York is having a Buy It Local holiday gift auction, and that's an online auction. And it ends December 18th, and they're selling some really great things, you know, supporting local farmers and organic programs. So check out their online auction, and that could be a good holiday gift for somebody. Also, December 17th through 19th, I Eat Green, we are having our annual Christmas event where we cook for the hungry in Jamaica, Queens, and we partner with the Riverfront Food Pantry that has a mobile food pantry that goes to Rufus King Park every other week. And for Thanksgiving and Christmas, we tag on and we provide a full Christmas dinner. For Thanksgiving, it was a much more complicated meal. This is really very simple. Baked ziti, Caesar salad, garlic bread, brownies, and apple pie. But I get hundreds of volunteers here at the I Eat Green Homestead to help cook this up, and it is a wonderful event. And then, of course, in the park, we're serving this food to people that have waited online for hours to not only get this incredible meal, but to partake of the coat drive that we've collected, lots of coats and winter items, also toys. There's a couple Santas there, or Santa and many helpers, to give gifts out to any children that show up, but also there's gifts for parents to take to be able to give to their children. So that's a really wonderful event, and if you want to participate on that, you can sign up on ieatgreen.com's website. December 18th is Brooklyn's 9th annual Latke Festival, and Great Performances funds this, and it's a great, great competition. It benefits the Sylvia Center, which is a nonprofit organization that addresses childhood diseases and food insecurity in the New York area. And they have a organic farm upstate called Catchkey Farm, and this is supporting that work. So if you like latkes, come on down and sample lots of latkes. Also, of course, the holidays are coming up, so there's not as many events going on that I know of that are open to everybody. But January 4th, there's a Food for Life, a Kickstart for Your Health, and it's a five-class series that you can sign up for. It takes place at the HM Spirituality Center
in Port Washington. That's on Long Island, and it's a Food for Life Kickstart Your Health classes for weight management and just learning how to eat right. Long Island Agricultural Forum, January 10th, and, of course, the NOFA New York Winter Conference, which I'm really excited about, January 19th through the 21st. This year, for the first time, I'll actually be doing a cooking demo up there, and I'm really excited to participate in that. But if you have not gone to the NOFA New York Winter Conference, it's definitely something you don't want to miss. There's hundreds of people coming together, farmers, food activists, consumers, everybody that cares about where their food's coming from in the New York area will be there. And they have great events in the evening. There's a big contra dance, and they screen films. And, of course, there's beautiful food that, you know, the vegetables are being donated by farmers. So, anyway, that's definitely worthwhile going to, and the early bird tickets are still available, so up through December 15th. So check that out. And now I want to share with you my recipe. This week's recipe is a stuffed squash with Asian tempeh and vegetables. And, you know, this time of year, I still have so many squash left from my garden that, you know, I'm always playing around with what I can do with it. And stuffing squash is one of my favorite things to do, partly because at the end of the season, I have many smaller ones, and they're beautiful individual portion-sized squashes. So you can really stuff them, and they're colorful, and it's a beautiful presentation on the plate. So for this one, I used some delicata squash, and also I had baby butternut squashes. And so I used each of those, and each person got a half of a delicata squash that was stuffed and half of a baby butternut squash. And it was delicious and maybe too much food, but really wonderful. So anyway, I used two delicata squashes and two baby butternut squashes for this recipe. I cut them in half and scooped out the seeds and the inside. The butternut squash only had a little section to scoop out, where the delicata squash, it was the length of the delicata squash that you scooped out. So I actually scooped out a little extra of the flesh of the butternut squash and just chopped that up, and that will go in the stir fry so that I had more room for stuffing. And then I needed 1 8-ounce block of your favorite tempeh. So whether just soybean or multi-grain tempeh, whatever you like. If you're gluten-free, you know, some of them are gluten-free and some of them have a grain in them that's not gluten-free. So you need to check that out. 1 onion chopped, 1 cup of diced carrots, 2 teaspoons of chopped garlic, 2 teaspoons grated ginger, 1/2 of a yellow pepper diced, 1 1/2 cups of broccoli florets, 2 tablespoons of tamari, 1 tablespoon of mirin, olive oil for sautéing, 2 tablespoons chopped parsley, and 2 cups of cooked brown rice. And I mixed my brown rice with a little bit of wild rice, so it had a little color with black grains in it, and it was very pretty. So, like I said, I first cut the squash in half, scooped out the seeds, cut up the extra flesh from the butternut squash, and I placed them in a Pyrex lasagna pan with a little bit of water. I covered it with parchment paper so that it wouldn't dry out on top and kind of steam. And I baked it in a 375-degree oven only for about 15 or 20 minutes, just till they got soft. Depending on the size of the squash, will depend on how long that takes. Meanwhile, in a cast iron pan, I sauteed the tempeh in some olive oil until golden brown. I turned over each piece individually so the other side could get golden brown as well. And then when it was finished, I splashed it with some tamari, about a tablespoon's worth. But I just put my fingers over the top of the tamari bowl and, just splashed the tempeh with that, and it seared from the heat of the pan. Just if you'd like, I just want to let you know you can also place those cubes of tempeh in the oven on some parchment paper, and that way you don't actually have to individually, you know, turn each piece over. It's a little bit easier, and that can be happening while you're sauteing the vegetables. So you can also do it in the oven if you'd like. Once the tempeh was finished, I took it out of the pan, just set it aside, and I wiped out the pan. And using the same pan, as you know, I like to wash as little of my pots and pans as possible. So I used the same pan. I sauteed the onions in a little bit of olive oil until they were translucent. Then I added the carrots. and the inside pieces of the squash and cooked that for 5 minutes or so. Then I added the broccoli, the garlic, and the ginger and cooked that down a little bit. Then I added the pepper. And just so you know, you're always adding the vegetables that are the root vegetables or the hardest, the ones that take longest to cook. So you're, you know, timing the vegetables so that when you add the last vegetable, which in this case is the peppers, which take very little time to cook, they're not going to get overcooked. Then you're going to add the mirin and the tamari, and that liquid, putting that liquid into the pan helps steam everything and bring all the flavors together. Then I added the tempeh back into the pan. I added the wild rice and the parsley and just mixed it up. Then I filled each of the squashes with the vegetable mixture. And basically the squash is already cooked and hot, and these vegetables are hot, so you're really just putting it all together for like 10 minutes. Bake it at 375 for about 10 minutes, or even 350 for 10 minutes, and that's it. And it's really delicious. Like I said, it makes a beautiful presentation on the plate, so do check that out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Annie Novak. She is the founder and director of Growing Chefs, which is a field-to-fork food education program. She's also manager of the Edible Academy at the New York Botanical Gardens and co-founder and farmer of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. She is in partnership with Google Green and Broadway Stages, who also own the buildings that the farm is on. And she's the author of a book called The Rooftop Growing Guide, How to Transform Your Roof into a Garden or Farm. And I'm really excited to talk to her about all these things and also the new project she's involved in. So, Annie, are you with me?
I am. Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing just fine. I'm actually a little under the weather, but I'm glad to be here and that you're a safe distance away. It's the season of getting sick, unfortunately, but I'm doing great.
Good. Good. So, I was hoping before we even get started, you could just share with us a little bit about your history. Like, how did you get into farming? Did you grow up on a farm? I know you're from the Midwest. You know, what was your interest in farming?
I actually didn't have a very strong horticultural background growing up, but the thing that drew me to farming, which is something I'm still involved in with all my different projects, is a really sincere love of being outdoors. I was lucky enough to grow up specifically on the Great Lakes, which, for folks on the coast, we love our oceans, but the Great Lakes system is one of the most beautiful resources in North America, and it's massive and diverse, and it's a really now ecologically and politically complicated region, which was part of my childhood. Growing up in Lake Michigan, there were a lot of politics around the care and sustainability of the lakefront because it's shared by so many states. And I just like being outside. So I think by the time I was lucky enough to start focusing on agriculture, part of my interest had a lot less to do with food, which was what usually brings people to farming, and a lot more to do with the conversation of how we interact with land and landscapes. So as someone who really cares about the outdoors, the dialogue around agriculture is a big part of that. So I honestly am a tree hugger much more than I'm a farmer, but I knew from years of watching people try and engage in conversations around environmental protection, it's a lot more enticing when you break bread with someone first. So I started growing food in order to get people to care about these larger landscapes.
Interesting. And I noticed also that you went to Sarah Lawrence, which is one of my favorite schools. Of course, my daughter went there. So
she's a fellow
Sarah Lawrence person. And, you know, the people coming out of that school are amazing in general.
Yeah,
I mean, I've met so many.
I appreciate you saying that. It's a neat school, and I'm sure part of what has informed your daughter's love, I hope she loved it as well. But for me, it was, you know, it's a school that's very small, and it's very student-driven, remains that way. It's remained small and student-driven. The thing I loved about it the most, which I carry forward into my work, is one of our professors, he passed before I was there, of course, but one of our most well-known professors was a fellow named Joseph Campbell. And perhaps many of your listeners have read his work. He wrote a lot about mythology, and he had this wonderful phrase, follow your bliss. And I think it's interpreted a lot as, you know, like, oh, just do what you feel and it's all cool. And it's not. It's very specific. He was a hardworking academic who believed in these really big picture stories about what we can do with our lives. And I'll just say that for me, what that helped with was when I was first starting the farm, it wasn't at all as popular or cool as it is today. And my mom wasn't very excited about me doing it, but I wanted to commit to something that felt, again, sort of on the scale of the way Joseph Campbell thinks, which is like, what is our purpose? Like, what are we here to do? And I knew I had this very core belief that I could try and create change through this type of work if I was dogmatic or principled about it, really. So I think, luckily, what Sarah Lawrence taught me was they are just a big yes, like, say yes. He had this other sentence, say yes to the hardy adventure. So I, you know, through some pretty, didn't make a lot of money right away. I wasn't, you know, entirely sure my family was in love with this idea. But through a lot of that, I just kept pushing because I felt, thanks to that type of education, that I could make it work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so Joseph Campbell, as much as Sarah Lawrence, really informed how I ended up where I am.
Uh-huh. Interesting. And also I read that you spent a year in Ghana, and I know Sarah Lawrence, unlike most schools where they just give you a semester abroad, they really encourage a full year. And I think part of it is because they don't have enough housing for everybody, so they really need people to get away for a year. But the experience of really going somewhere for a year, you really have to immerse yourself in the whole scene. And so my daughter spent a year in Italy, and of course, mm-hmm. you know, she's an art historian, and that's her bliss that she followed. But you went to Ghana, which is really interesting, because that probably didn't did that have anything to do with what you were studying in school?
Well, yeah. So I was only there for a semester, to correct that, and I'm actually glad that I did, because that semester abroad was followed then by some traveling. And then I came back, and it helped me focus my studies. So I was a West Africanist. I was studying human geography and political development, or political science, and focusing on West Africa in particular, just because it's such a connected geography to the East Coast. You know, just because of the transatlantic slave route, there's a lot of shared vocabulary between storytelling and language and traditions, and it's kind of a random connection, but I was really interested in textiles at the time, and the American Southeast has a really interesting quilting culture that takes a lot of cues from West Africa. So I went to West Africa not interested in food, and I think it was within the first week of school that I made friends with someone whose father had founded the largest and first fair trade chocolate company in West Africa. My friend Nana Kwesi, and Kwapa Koko, the company that his father founded, now sells through Divine, which you can buy here, Divine Chocolate.
Yeah.
And it was
mm-hmm.
in meeting him that I then decided to focus on agriculture, because everything I was looking at in terms of narrative and shared spaces, I mean, this is the way a human geographer would talk about a commodity, I found in chocolate, because it's a really interesting food. We spend a lot of money on it. It's a pleasure food. It's not necessary. So for me, again, thinking about ways to get people to make responsible decisions as consumers, chocolate seemed like a great place to start. You will willingly spend an extra dollar on chocolate that's better for people and ecosystems, because it's not a daily object. It's a pleasure. So I wanted to start to talk to people about that. And then Akwesi, like, he changed my life. I mean, that meeting him and getting that experience and working with farmers in West Africa set me on the path I am today, now mm-hmm. 14 years later.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing what you've done in that 14 years.
Yeah.
So let's go back to what you started here, right here in Brooklyn, the Eagle Street Farm. You want to tell us, how did that come into birth?
So the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, you mentioned it briefly in your introduction, and thank you for that. It's owned by Broadway Stages, which is a really interesting company. They've been in Greenpoint for a while, and they own real estate that houses television and film production studio spaces. So the farm is actually on top of a soundstage where right now, for example, they're filming Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. They're filming Rise now. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was there last year, along with Aziz Ansari's show, Master of None, which is fun because every now and again I'm walking down the hallway with rabbit poop in my hands in a bucket. And I think a couple years ago I like ran into Taylor Swift. So things happen. But the way that the farm started, I was lucky to be present. I mean, Good Green, which is a green roof company that Broadway Stages contracted to build the green roof. My co-founder Ben Slanner had been doing a little bit of research about starting a rooftop farm in New York City, and he actually contacted Good Green and pulled me into the conversation after he met me at a farmer's market, where I was sort of known as like the girl who talks about produce and farming all the time. So I got brought in as a co-founder, and then ended up after 5 months taking over the operation, and Ben then went on to found the Brooklyn Grange, which is the other large-scale greenery farm in New York City. And the two of us still remain, I think, one of the few large-scale, fully commercial rooftop green roof farms in the world. And right now there are a lot of good green roof projects that are nonprofits, and there are certainly a lot more green roofs. But it's still kind of an uphill battle to get people farming commercial land roofs. It's expensive and a lot of work. But anyway, so that happened in 2009, and it's been going strong ever since. Probably the coolest thing to come out of the farm is we have this really amazing volunteer program that trains young people in urban farming. So it's on the rooftop farm, but we also do field trips. And that has seen, I think, over 120 people go through the program in the last 8 years, I guess it would be, if that's right. No, less than that. Yeah, 8 years. So that's pretty cool. I mean, education was a big part of why I like to farm. I was an apprentice for many farmers myself. So that's probably at this point our most impactful.
What's the name of that program? What's the name of that program where people can go through and be trained?
Yeah, it's a volunteer apprenticeship program. So it's with the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm.
Okay, so it's an apprenticeship program. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Sounds great. And so 120 people, you've been in business for 7 years
now? 2009.
Mm-hmm. 2009, okay. So how many people is that a year? Less than
It varies.
12.
And, you know, I should also mention we have a volunteer day. So we have days where anyone from the public can come up and work with us as well. I mean, we're running a for-profit farm, so at this point, a lot of why we do all that outreach has a lot less to do with the labor people offer. I think, generally speaking, volunteers come up and they help a lot. But if it's their first time being up there, it's not necessarily work. It's just exposure and experience. So the ways that we've been staying commercially viable is we sell to chefs, and then we have a market, and then we also make a hot sauce product, which I really love, because one of the funny things about green roofs is they're not necessarily the easiest growing environment. And for everyone listening who's getting excited about rooftop gardening, one of the reasons I wrote a book is because rooftop gardening is really challenging. And when you pick up a book and they talk about rooftop gardening, they're usually focusing on containers, which at the end of the day is the way most people are going to end up approaching their rooftop, because it's the least capital intensive. But there are now a lot of green roof, container, and greenhouse projects. So the book sort of covers all of that. And green roofs, what I love about them is that even if you have a hard time growing vegetables, which, for example, we do, it's an arid, quickly draining, shallow soil growing environment. So that's very challenging. That said, everything that a green roof offers, stormwater mitigation, heat island remediation, habitat, all of that, insulation for the building in the winter, all of that is there, even if there weren't vegetables. So at the end of the day, one of the reasons I keep gunning for green roofs is it's a little bit about food, but it's an awful lot about sustainable city infrastructure. And that's something we cover a lot in the book, just because I think ultimately I would rather see a green roof on every roof than a farm.
Right,
but
absolutely.
If we can have both, great, let's do it.
Now, are all roofs suitable for green roofs, or do they have to have some infrastructure added to it in order to take on that extra weight?
Well, it's partially about weight. I mean, not all roofs, absolutely not. You can, for example, you can take out most buildings in the Southwest because, or not Southwest, but like the anywhere where you're not getting regular snowfall, because roofs mm-hmm. in the Northeast, for example, were designed for snow load. So they're going to have a certain weight bearing capacity based on snow load that might accommodate additionally a rooftop garden as well as access, like human access and use. So one of the things to think about is if you want to put a rooftop garden on top of your roof, why? I mean, is it because you don't have anywhere on the ground to grow? Is it because your city does get a lot of regular storm events that you want to help capture rainwater? There are a lot of things to think through before you just traipse up the stairs. And then the other thing is every city has its own rules about legal access. So in New York City, for example, if your parapet, which is the edge of the wall around the roof, if that's not higher than 42 inches, then you're not legally allowed access to the roof. So Structural support is an obvious thing.
Is that something that you can add?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and I think, I mean, retrofitting a building is likely going to be one of the more expensive parts of doing a greener for a garden, but of course you can do that. And I mean, if the money is there, I would encourage people to do it for sure. One thing I kind of think is funny is that buildings, every building going into construction should consider a roof garden, but the honest to goodness truth is the roof is the last thing they build. So often if you're over budget, you might build it to be capable of having a green roof, but the green roof itself might get shrunk or dismissed, you know, just because people get out of money at the end of a project. So I always find that kind of funny. But, yeah, I mean, probably the best way to look at this is that from a municipal level, state and federal funding often end up being the lead drivers of a building owner's interest in building a green roof. Everyone has, I mean, most people in a conversation will have a feel-good mentality around doing it, and they'll say, I want to do it. But if you don't have either a tax abatement or grant funding or, in the example of D.C., D.C. has, between the carrot and the stick approach, D.C. has the stick, they will fine you if you're not addressing your stormwater management. So you see a lot more green roofs in D.C. because if you don't, there's a fine affiliated with it, which is basically just taxing people or pricing the value of water that isn't captured by a permeable surface. So it could be that you don't have enough lawn or ground gardens. It could be that you don't have enough green roof space, whatever. In New York, for a while, I don't actually remember where this funding is at, but in New York, you have the carrot. So instead of the stick, you have the carrot. And the carrot is you can get a tax break if you decide out of the beauty of your own heart to install a green roof. So where I see green roofs getting installed most quickly is often in the places where you are taxed or fined if you don't. And usually this has to do with water remediation more than anything else. It's not, you wouldn't see a green roof getting installed and you getting a tax break because you're growing vegetables for people. It's not phrased that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it does have all those other benefits.
Hopefully your listeners aren't asleep right now, but this, at the end of the day, like where we will see infrastructure change has a lot to do with funding. So yay vegetables.
Right. Now you said you have, you sell your vegetables in both to chefs and to a market. Do you also run a CSA?
No, we don't anymore. We did for a while, but our farm, after a few years of trying a CSA, the thing that's beautiful about a CSA is for the farmer, it gives you money up front. And for the consumer, it gives you a wide range of produce that you can experiment with and be exposed to over the course of a year. And we just, for the amount of diversity of our crops to support a CSA, we were just growing things that didn't suit our space. And I'm a really big fan of the absolutely red letter rule, right plant, right place. If you're trying to grow something where it ought not be grown, you're going to end up putting more energy and effort into something ecologically and personally than you need to. So we canceled our CSA in order to focus on the crops that I know do well botanically on our site.
Uh-huh. So what vegetables don't work well on the roof?
My answer is going to be pretty microclimate specific. I guess for the benefit of your listeners, probably the easier thing to say is what vegetables tend not to do well on a roof in general. So plants will always grow a leaf. They need that to make their own food. So almost anything you eat that's a leaf that's edible, you can try and grow on a roof. There are going to be certain plants like lettuce or mustard greens that it might be better to grow them as small leaves than try to get them to head size, in part because when plants go through stress, like if they're on a roof and it's too sunny or too shady, they're going to start to produce flowers because they want to go into the reproductive cycle faster before they die. So I have, for example, struggled with growing lettuce that doesn't taste bitter because when lettuce starts to produce seeds, it pulls sugar from the leaves and then that in turn changes the flavor. So I can grow a great lettuce on the ground where there's lots of shade and water. On a rooftop, I've struggled with lettuce. So we just grow microgreen lettuce now. Another good rule is if you know that a plant in its state of panic is going to start to grow seeds, anything that the seed is something you eat or the fruit, which would contain the seed, is something you eat, might do well on a roof. So, for example, we grow a lot of chili peppers because the more stressed out a chili is, the better it tastes. It gets nice and spicy. So we've settled on plants like that, basically. And then, like, an obvious thing is, you know, really water-hungry plants like a watermelon or corn, We've grown them, but they're terrible. So mm-hmm. that's kind of a good rule for rooftops.
I would think squashes probably aren't so good up there either, just because they require so much space.
Yeah, I mean, watermelon and squash could be considered equivalent. I just I didn't even bother with squash. Okay, no,
right.
That's not going to work.
Right. Yeah. Annie, let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the programs you run over at the New York Botanical Gardens. Okay.
Great. Yeah,
so everyone,
the Bronx. Wonderful.
Yeah. Don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Annie Novak from Eagle Street Farm, and I will be right back.
It's not liberal. It's not conservative. It's progressive. The truth that empowers. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Get your daily dose of happy each morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on PRN. LOA Today is expanding to appear on PRN now 5 mornings per week, Monday through Friday. I'm Walt Thiessen, the host of LOA Today. The way you start your day sets the tone for the rest of the day, so start it happy. We explore the realm of positive psychology, the law of attraction, and the power of positive thinking, and we have a heck of a lot of fun in the process. You'll find yourself smiling each morning. That's LOA Today, weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Time here on PRN.
Stay tuned to PRN.fm for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and I.E. Green on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Annie Novak, co-founder of Eagle Street Farm and founder of the Edible Academy at the New York Botanical Gardens. And that's actually what I want to talk about right now. Annie, are you with me?
I am. Hello.
Hi. Can you tell us about this program that you started called the Edible Academy at the New York Botanical Gardens in the Bronx?
Sure. So, yeah, so it's the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, and then the New York Botanical Garden has for 60-plus years had a children's gardening program, and for the past 30 years it's been hosted by the Family Garden, where I started as an intern 13 years ago. And I am now the manager of the Edible Academy, which is a site that many, many people at the Botanic Garden worked on to grow. We've been working on it for about 8 years. And what it does is it takes our current site, which is a 2-acre vegetable garden that's open to the public, as well as runs some really wonderful children's gardening programming and family events, and it takes that 2-acre site and has transformed it into a space that now has 2 indoor classrooms, a greenhouse, an amphitheater. It's all hopefully going to be certified LEED Gold. We're working on that now because it has composting bathrooms, solar panels, geothermal. What else are we doing? We have a green roof. It's a really beautiful campus. And if people are curious, you can actually look now. We have some renderings online at nybg.org/edibleacademy. And it's going to be, I think, one of the most premier children's education gardening sites in the country. There's really nothing like it. We've done a lot of traveling around comparing programs, and it's very unique. And it serves, at the moment, we have a visitorship on just our 2-acre vegetable site of about 50,000 visitors a year. The garden, the larger garden, sees about 1 million a year. And we're hoping to double our capacity now because we'll have these 2 beautiful classrooms as well as a much larger gardening space to work with. So we're all very, very excited about it. It'll be opening in June next year. June 14th is the weekend that it opens. And like I said, we've been working on it for 8 years just in terms of funding and design, and it's a really unique and incredible space, and I'm lucky to be the manager.
Oh, that's so exciting. Very exciting. And so are the classrooms, are you going to be having classes for the general public, or is it really children-focused?
The site It's in the Children's Education Department at the New York Botanical Garden. The larger garden has a really incredible adult education program, as well as just general public visitorship and exhibitions and scientific research. And, you know, it's a very large institution. There are over 600 people that work there. Our site focuses primarily on children and family programming, but in the afternoon we're open to the general public every single day except for Mondays. And that I've seen all sorts. I've seen, you know, people come through on a date. I've seen people come through with their grandparents. That it's for everyone. But the core programs we focus on are school trip visits, an enrolled children's gardening program, which is specifically for 3 to 12 year olds. And then we also have started working on new programming, camps, and school partnerships. So we'll let schools come for multiple visits. So it's a pretty dynamic place. And I, like I said, I've been working there for 13 years. I think that's correct. And even in that time, I've seen it change and grow just because we have so many good people working for us. We're constantly developing new programming. But the core focus really is it's a one space at the New York Botanical Garden where any participant can come in of any age and get their hands dirty. We let people plant with us. They harvest with us. And then in addition to that, we have this whole suite of curriculum focusing on STEM, as well as, you know, explorations of other parts of our campus. We have a beautiful 50-acre forest in the middle of the Bronx. It's incredible. I mean, I was standing there yesterday, and I'm looking at a 300-year-old white oak tree in the Bronx. You know, it's unbelievable. I feel so lucky to work there because you can stand in that space, and you forget you're in New York, but the amazing thing is you are. So there's really nothing like it to be half an hour away from Lincoln Center while staring at a 300-year-old oak tree is mind-blowing. It's a very fortunate place to work and visit.
Uh-huh. Well, you really did manage to find a way to be outdoors and be in New York for your livelihood, which was your goal, and it's hard to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I would push back on that a little bit because I think one of the cool things about New York and why I've never left is that we have forests and wetlands and marshlands and coastline and swamps and great public spaces. So the fact that we think about New York as a primarily urban environment is a little bit of a disservice to the really incredible work that's been done by conservationists within the five boroughs. Mm-hmm. So I'm always amazed by that. And like I said, the New York Botanical Garden sees a million people a year. I would be curious of those million people that visit, how many of them actually do what I do, which is often just literally sit in front of a tree and stare at it and think about it for a while, because that is the resource that I think is missing. A lot of New Yorkers pass through Central Park very quickly, or they go to the beach only in the summer. But the reality is if you spend time there every day or as often as possible or once a week, you know, go to the beach in the winter and see what you learn. That's part of the beauty of living in a city like this, is the A train takes you out to a place where you can go see a snowy owl in the middle of January. And that's a bird from the Arctic tundra that just happens to be on Coney Island because it's migrating. So I think that's really not to be lost in living in a concrete jungle.
Right. Well, talking about migrating takes me to your next project, or your current project, or another one of your many projects that you're involved in, is really observing the migration of nocturnal birds. Can you share with us a little bit about this new project you're working on?
Sure. So the book that I'm researching for now is it's a nonfiction illustrated book for adults about nocturnally migrating birds. So a lot of the birds that we're familiar with from the daytime, actually in the spring and the fall in the East Coast, fly at night. And it's just because it's a lot easier for them. They use the stars to navigate. There also is less turbulent wind at night. They might be able to avoid predators that way. And the reason I became fascinated in it is actually because of a really beautiful and evocative landmark of New York City, which is the Tribune in Light. And that's a moment on September 11th, in which downtown New York is illuminated by these two huge light installations representing the Twin Towers and what was lost during the terrorist attack of September 11th. And I've always been deeply moved by that memorial. My first year of college was 9/11. It was my second day of classes. And that moment, the few days after the attacks, when New York was recovering and the sky was so silent, I mean, it was empty of airplanes for days, really stayed with me. And I take care of a rooftop garden that overlooks the Tribune in Light directly. It's directly across the street from the parking garage that hosts it. And one day I was up on the rooftop garden during the tribute, And I looked into the beam, and I saw what looked like thousands and thousands of what I thought were bats, because it was nighttime, and as everybody knows, bats fly at night. But the movement was different. And I remember turning to the apartment owner, who I take care of the garden for, and I said, "What is that? Is that bats?" And he said, "No, those are birds." And it was an epiphany for me, because I think what people don't realize about migration is that it's not all birds that fly at night. Many birds fly during migration during the day, and we see them. I mean, we all see geese, for example, Canada geese. But the birds that were moving were small neotropical migrants. These are small, brightly colored songbirds. It was a lot of shorebirds, which are one of the groups that are very much in danger of losing habitat to development. So these aren't large, brave, powerful birds. These are the small, brave, powerful birds, brightly colored, beautiful songs. And the reason they were entrained in the lights is because as they migrate, one of the tools they use is where the sun is setting, and then they're sensitive to polar fields. So they were pulled into the light because of the jury's still out on the science, but basically they become captured by the light, and then they get lost in it, just like you can imagine a deer in a headlight effect. And I think, just quickly, because I could talk about this book for hours, but the thing that most captured me is that I love farming, what brought me to that space, because I love being outdoors in these wide open spaces. And the moments in which I would stand in a field until sunset and then have the night sky pull up with stars was a really important moment for me in my day. It signaled rest and reflection. And you can look into the infinity of the stars and feel this really strong connection to space and the thought of the cosmos, and like feel smaller as a human in this larger world of many, many other species besides just Homo sapiens. And so when I was looking out into the Tribune of the Lights and seeing all these birds who were thrown off of a path they've been following for millions of years, I mean, birds, this evolution of migration is so deeply ingrained in their genetics. And these lights were taking them off that track in a really visible way. So it was this weird emotional moment, because, again, I love what that tribute represents, and I love being in New York City where bright lights make you feel safe at night and, you know, this glittering skyline. But there was some obvious conflict happening here. Right. So that was the beginning of it. And then since then, what I've really been looking at is how technology like radar and better acoustics monitoring and artificial intelligence has allowed us to piece together this really hidden story of what is nocturnal migration. And I'll just say one more thing, and I promise I'm done. But the thing that's most interesting to me is that in the 1950s, Rachel Carson, who many of your listeners might know as the author of Silent Spring, she wrote a book about the ocean. And it was the first time for many people that the ocean, instead of being a dark, cold, dead space, with her and Jacques Cousteau coming out with all these color photographs, we started to realize the ocean is lively and vibrant. And that is true for the air. And the study of aeroecology, the ocean of life, the migrating dragonflies and aphids and plankton and pollen and bacteria, all of that moving through the sky, all of that is affected by things like light pollution and development. And then the key thing is, where do these birds land when they fly all night? They're calorically exhausted. They're borrowed from Latin America. We borrow them for 4 months. They live up with us for a very short amount of time. And then they go back to places in South and Central America, or they go up to the Arctic. That story to me, this is the time to tell it, because the technology is available to us. As I mentioned, with radar and artificial intelligence is letting us read faster and more rapidly the acoustic monitoring data we've been doing with birds. So all that to say, I only learned all this stuff in the last year, but I just spent 14 years farming because I care about land, and now to turn my attention to another system that is connected again to land use. When you develop a soy field, how does that affect a group of warblers in Brazil? That's all really interesting to me. So that's what I'm looking at now.
Mm-hmm. It is fascinating, because it isn't something that you usually think about. And, you know, just getting people to really think about the life in soil is, you know, a whole new thing. And for so many people, it still is. You know, I mean, it's one of the discussions that's coming up so much with hydroponics versus soil, you know, organic grown in soil, you know. And is it the same? And how can it be the same if you don't have the beneficial insects, you know, contributing to the nutrient level of the plants? And, you know, I mean, there's so many fascinating questions with all of this.
Yeah, you know what, I think it's so interesting because we're in a position now to be better scientists than we ever have been. We have so many tools at our fingertips to answer these important questions. And what I find so funny about it is that it's people are so quick to tie problems up with a bow. I mean, nutrition is a really good field for this, but, you know, everybody wants to jump right into one form of eating because it's faster and quicker, and I'm watching this happen with growing meat proteins. You know, growing meat protein is really interesting technology, and I think it's going to help a lot with, like, saving water, hopefully, which, you know, eating meat in general is very water consumptive. But the question I always ask, and I'm a vegetarian, so I'm slightly biased, is why do we think the short answer is the right answer? Like, you know, you can't tie things up like that and expect you're not going to have some sort of nutrient loss or discover later if there's something unhealthy about it. So I'm not saying it's a cynicism at all, because I'm very optimistic, but my vote is always take the time to run the studies, take the time to see what the results are, and you know, unfortunately, I just think we don't. You know, culturally, we're very interested in getting things done very quickly. And you definitely see that. I've been seeing that all along with agriculture, which is funny, because it's a 10,000-year-old culture, and we've learned a lot in that time, and it's really been in the last century that we've just been like, go, go, go. To our detriment, as you mentioned, with soil, which is just getting less and less nutritious, and we're not caring for it the way we could. So,
well, also, when you talk about, you know, doing the research and the funding, you know, I mean, there is no funding for research except from the corporations that benefit from the sale of these synthetic nutrients or chemicals or whatever. So, And our government, you know, as you know, the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Agriculture, I mean, they depend on the studies from the chemical companies or the corporations that, you know, are going to benefit from the positive research. So, you know, if they have negative research, they don't have to publicize it, and they only publicize what is advantageous to their product. So it's not a good situation. But I love the work that you're doing. You just have your hands in so many wonderful things. Now, Growing Chef, can you tell us about that? Is that part of the Edible Academy?
No, I started Growing Chef back in 2006, right after
still going?
I graduated college the year before. Yeah, and I started in part because at the time there wasn't really a program similar to Edible Schoolyard on the East Coast, and I didn't want to go to the West Coast or elsewhere. So it was a program that I started on my own as a college graduate to create a teaching program looking at food from field to fork. And what's been nice is that I think because I work, at the time I was part-time at the Botanical Garden, and now I'm full-time, so as my work there transitioned and just sort of general sentiment around food education changed, a lot of the ideas in Growing Chef became incorporated into lots of other things, my work, other people's work. But yeah, it's still a really great program. We have some partnerships with local schools, and we're fiscally sponsored by a wonderful organization called the Open Space Institute. And what they do is any of the funding that we generate for our program, part of that is tied to their work, and their work very specifically purchases and then protects land, which I couldn't think of a better relationship. So anytime we do any programming, we're also helping fund and support Open Space Institute, which is a really marvelous and longstanding program protecting our watershed and our airshed. So I do have my fingers in a lot of pies, but part of the reason I stay committed to everything is because this all feeds into this larger message of how do we approach land conservation. Whether you're interested in birds or vegetables or hot sauce or children's education, there are a lot of different ways to keep these spaces open and beautiful for people, but for habitat as well, for everything else besides human beings.
Now, how many hours are in each of your days?
I live on a parallel planet of the 40-hour day. You know, it's a funny thing, actually, with the bird book, because I'm studying nocturnal migration, I can go to my day job and then still stay up and work on birds. You know, there have been a lot of nights this year where I'll be awake between, you know, 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. listening for birds or watching the radar. And then I just know that sometime in February I'll probably sleep for a week, and then I'll be back at it again. But that's the nice thing about eating vegetables for a living is you're pretty healthy. And, you know, besides this weekend where I did get a little sick, but it's sort of back to school season sickness, post-holiday sickness. I don't know. I love everything that I do, and probably among your listeners there are people like that. I wouldn't ever self-describe as a workaholic because it's so – my work and my life are so deeply interconnected.
Inclined.
It's a very fortunate position, and anytime I feel like complaining about it, I remember how darn lucky I am, so I stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. You're passionate about all the different projects, and they are all intertwined. We're almost out of time, but I would love to just get your input a little bit on what's going on with the bats, since you are paying attention to nocturnal birds, and that is what most of us think about. I used to have lots of bats on my property here, and I haven't had any, and I even got some bat houses to try to attract them. What's going on with them?
Well, I'm by no means a bat expert, but you're bringing up a larger question, which I appreciate. One is that we tend to notice things when they're disappearing, which
right.
at that point I might wonder if it's a little too late. So one thing I would encourage your listeners to do now that I've gone on and on about the beauties of the natural world is, put your phone in your pocket, and when you're walking around to work or to play next time, just observe what you're seeing. I actually, if you don't mind my co-opting your question, people notice animals. They'll notice squirrels and bats and birds. There's a really sincere plant blindness in the U.S. And I like laugh sometimes when I'll talk to a friend and they'll say, "What's that in that tree?" And I'm like, "Which tree?" And they say, "Oh, the green one over there." And I'm like, "Well, no, but it, like, it's an oak or a maple or a linden," or like there's a vocabulary that's lost because people just don't notice what tree is in front of their house. So I would suggest that the first step towards conservation and preserving these populations, like where are the bats going, is to start noticing things and to know their names and their qualities and what they need. And you could probably answer your own question, where are the bats going, if you know where they are and what they need. Bats in particular, I have to say, it's smutty nose disease, and that's a fungal problem that they've been dealing with for a while now. But one optimistic thought, most animals and plants have a really tremendous biological capacity to rebound if resources return. So the monarch butterfly is an example of something that if you let a monarch go through all of its generations within a single year, they have the biological capacity of laying 7 million monarchs. So if we just give monarchs milkweed back and we give monarchs their overwintering forest back, their population will come back within a year or two to its former numbers. But so that's the thing I keep an eye on is support
right. and
the
we're
things
doing
they
that
need
with
and they'll
return. Too, hopefully. Okay, so anyway, we are officially out of time, Annie. So you want to just share your website so people can find you?
Yes, nybt.org is probably the best place to start, or annienovak.wordpress.com.
Wonderful. Thanks, Annie, so much. Everyone listening, it's been great. I'm sorry we're out of time. We'll be with you next week, and I'll post all of Annie's information on my website. See you all again next week. Bye for now.